everybody. Welcome to the very first episode of the Forensic Anthropology Journal Companion Podcast, a place for authors from the journal Forensic Anthropology to talk a little more in depth about their articles and also to stimulate research ideas amongst the field at large. I'm your host, Michael Kennyhurst, and in this episode, I'll be chatting with the authors of Volume 3, Issue 1. Before we get into it, I'd like to talk a little bit about the format for this podcast. We have chosen five main questions to ask all of our authors. 1. What is the basic idea of the paper, and what are three major takeaways you think people should get from it? This is the too long didn't read, or TLDR, version of the article. 2. How did you get involved into this type of research? 3. What is an aspect of your research that you think might get missed? 4. How would you design the perfect experiment to study this? And 5. How would you recommend practitioners utilize your research? Additionally, I, or another host, will have some general questions we have about things we found fascinating about their research, just to facilitate a little bit deeper of a discussion. But first, I wanted to sit down with two of the editors of Forensic Anthropology, Drs. Joseph Hefner and Nicholas Passalacqua, to talk about the history of the journal, why they started it, how they went about it, where they see it heading, and what they hope to get out of this podcast. So why did they start this journal?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's something that I've never really given much thought to.
That's Dr. Joseph Hefner.
I know that Nick and I were working at DPAA.
The Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency.
Together. And, you know, a big part of it was that we were there together. Marin Palud and I had just come off of a book, writing up the BioDistance book, and had discussed the slow rate of publication that was going on with a lot of places at that time. And what's funny is that was one of the initial reasons that we started a journal, because we really wanted to have something where we could increase the speed, right? We wanted to move from submission to online publication as quickly as possible.
And Dr. Nicholas Passalacqua.
You know, at the time, Angie and I were really frustrated with the publication lag time. And I remember being basically a year and a half was like fast. And it was just a really frustrating time. And so we were kind of talking about that and kind of talking about just generally how, I mean, JFS is a fine journal. There's nothing wrong with it. But it's also all forensic sciences kind of pooled into one thing. And, you know, some issues have a bunch of good forensic anthropology stuff, and some have maybe just one or two articles. And so it didn't seem reasonable that that was the only kind of publication venue for forensic anthropology. And so Angie and I, of course, were also working on some textbook stuff at the same time. And, you know, being great friends with Joe, we were all kind of talking together about these kind of same frustrations with publishing and kind of just being generally, I use the word dissatisfied, but more so in terms of like things could be better than they are.
Really wanted a place where it could be forensic anthropology, forensic archaeology, all under one heading. And to be honest, at least for me, one of my interests in it was a legacy thing, you know, something else that we could kind of leave for the next generation of forensic anthropologists. I mean, it's like the cover design. The cover design is based on old AJPA.
The American Journal of Physical Anthropology.
Back in the, you know, early AJPA, because it's just really simple. It's a simple, straightforward thing. We kind of paid homage to Herdlishka with the cover, because that's a skull on the front that he collected, and, you know, even the font. So it's all these things that are kind of a return to our roots in some ways, revisiting a dedicated journal to forensic anthropology in much the same way I think that Herdlishka wanted to have a dedicated journal for physical anthropology rather than something that was anatomy and, you know, all these other things that would have been there at the time.
You know, forensic anthropology is its own discipline, right? It's its own thing. It's not subservient to biological anthropology, and it stands on its own and also needs to incorporate forensic archaeology. And so that's another thing that we really tried to emphasize with this journal, is we didn't want it to be just another venue for skeletal publications. We really wanted to embrace archaeology, taphonomy, and other aspects of forensic anthropology that don't always get thought of or sometimes get overlooked when you just kind of generally think of old-timey, you know, ideas of forensic anthropology.
Absolutely. You know, the
the big thing that I like too that we're doing that kind of is in that same vein is incorporating things like in our commingled issue out of DPAA, Sarah Wagner, cultural anthropologist, writes the including remarks on that. I mean, it's not something you would see in AJPA or maybe even in JFS. And so these special issues, we're able to do that because we make all the decisions. Yeah. University of Florida Press has been phenomenal, and we, you know, obviously couldn't do this without them. They were immediately on board. They wanted to grab onto forensics and forensic anthropology, and they have been so supportive by allowing us to do things like these special issues where we can go to a poster session at the academy meetings, or we can approach colleagues who are working on some interesting things and say, let's just throw them all together in one issue. And for academics, there's a big difference between an edited book chapter and a manuscript in a journal. And so I think that's another service that we're able to provide. As far as directions that we're heading in, one of the things that we're doing right now is a big push for review articles. We've got requests for about, I don't know, 15 or so out. And then we just got one in on the history of forensic anthropology. We have one in on age estimation that's kind of going through. And so we're going to push for those. Obviously, we have quite a few original research articles that are in. I think with the COVID-19 kind of global pandemic, I suspect we're gonna see a decrease in submissions. One of the things that we're hoping that'll come out of this podcast, of course, and of course we want a podcast too, so don't blow it. But the idea of the podcast also is just to kind of stimulate interest in the journal and have folks submitting articles, technical reports, case reports. That was another big thing that Nick really wanted from the journal too. Before I forget, case reports, right? You know, kind of this return to the idea that we can learn from our cases, and that the informative nature of case reports shouldn't be forgotten. And I think, you know, it's really hard to get a case report in other journals right now, if not damn near impossible. And so to have those case reports available has been a boon, in my opinion.
Yeah, you know, another thing that we have going on right now is Diane France just started being a special editor for historical biography type papers that we're hoping to start. So she's been working with a few people that have reached out to her, and, you know, anybody that's listening to this can reach out to her as well. And, you know, that was just kind of came from this project that I was kind of working on, where I was trying to figure out some information about somebody that was passed away and they didn't have a published biography about them. And it just became really difficult to find out more about, you know, how they got into the discipline and kind of what they did and why they did it. And so we thought it would be interesting to start reaching out to some of our more senior folks and just like, while they're still around, let's ask them some interesting questions and let's find out what they have to say. It's something that I would want to read, so I assume other people might want to read it too, and really excited that Diane, you know, wanted to kind of take the reins on that and move forward with it.
So how can you get involved?
Well, we always need submissions. So write up that research that you've been working on that, you know, you presented 2 years ago and just kind of keep forgetting about. Additionally, we can always use reviewers. If you're interested in being a reviewer, probably the easiest way to do it is to just go to the Scholar One Forensic Anthropology website, and you can create an account there and you can add in keywords. And so that way, if someone needs a reviewer and there's an article about, you know, thermal trauma or something, maybe you added thermal and trauma as two different keywords, and so your name might come up if they search some of those words. We're probably going to start rotating some associate editors out in the next year or so. Joe's kind of stepped up as the current lead editor of the three of us, so he'll probably be taking the lead in that whole process. But I think maybe by the end of this year or so, we're going to do something like that.
You know, you can email either one of us or Angie Christensen. You know, she's a big part of it too. And just email. We have a few folks that have already expressed interest, but we have probably, I would say we probably have about four or five spots that'll open up by the end of the year. If you have research cohorts that you're working with, and you have ideas for special issues, you can reach out to any one of us also, and we can kind of talk you through that process.
So what's next?
We have some exciting special issues coming up.
So some of the ones that are, I would say, either near or maybe like halfway done. We have one on qualifications that's coming up that should be done really soon. We have one, so it's basically a dual language special issue. So the articles are going to be in both Spanish and translated into English. So I'm pretty excited about that. I think that'll be really cool. We'd love to kind of do more things like that. This is kind of a test case.
Yeah, before I forget, we should also give a shout out to Michaela Spiros, who is our social media extraordinaire. She's taking care of our Instagram account and our Twitter account. But I encourage everyone to check out the Twitter account at JForensicAnt. Kayla's running that, though, and she's got a great thing going where she's putting on, maybe once a week, once every other week, she's putting up a call out to one of the articles that we've had in some past. So she's going through the first, what are we on now? We've had two volumes out. We're on our third. Is this the third year already? So we're on our third year. So she's got plenty to go back and check out. And we did it. To be honest, I don't know if we thought that it would last 2 years. I thought we had a good shot at a year.
I don't know. I don't think we said this at the top, but Angie would love to be on this call. She's just as dedicated as any of us. She's just not able to be here.
That's right.
And finally,
thanks to all the contributors, of course, right? Thanks to everyone that's writing articles. Thanks to everybody that's helping review articles. Thanks to everybody that's, you know, doing associate editor duties. Thanks to everybody that's reached out to us with special issue ideas. You know, I mean, the journal doesn't exist because of Joe and Angie and I. You know, the journal exists because the community participates in it and supports it.
Essentially, having your own journal allows for timeliness in publication and a certain amount of flexibility in the types of content that you can provide. To me, though, this marks a shift in our field, and as Nick had pointed out earlier in the chat, forensic anthropology may have started as an applied branch of physical anthropology, but it has since evolved into its own rich field of study. First on deck is Moisture Content in Decomposing, Desiccated, and Mummified Human Tissue by Autumn Leonards, Michelle Hamilton, and Russell Weaver. Autumn was nice enough to have a chat about her paper based on her master's thesis. This paper examined moisture loss in superficial soft tissues at several different sites around the body to understand the relationship of tissue moisture content with the post-mortem interval, or PMI. To facilitate this research, Autumn and colleagues used a moisture reader, which she will describe, and the total body scoring system developed by Dr. Mary Magasy and colleagues. Essentially, the total body score is a means to characterize the state of human decomposition based on suites of morphological characteristics throughout different regions of the body. The sum of these scores is then converted into accumulated degree days, or ADD, which essentially measures both temperature and time as a thermal unit. With this estimate, you can work backwards to establish a post-mortem interval. Autumn is currently in the process of applying to PhD programs to continue her research and specialization in taphonomy and natural mummification processes, and was generous enough to take some time to talk more about her research. So thank you so much for doing this. So I guess I'll just jump kind of right into it. So if you could just like give us like a basic idea of kind of like the paper with three main takeaways, things that you thought were like super important to know about this paper.
Yeah. So kind of the basic premise of the study was just to see if this was even kind of a research pathway that has any kind of foundation. I was noticing that there's not really any existing literature surrounding it. And so I kind of wanted to see, is that because it can't be done or just because nobody's done it yet? And so kind of the big takeaways were, one, that this aspect of the literature is really, really scarce. And I think that's a problem. Also that this is an avenue that can and should be pursued. And then just, I think one of the most surprising things from it was that humidity doesn't have as much of an effect on mummification as I think everybody kind of thought it would. Temperature was a little bit predictable, but I think a lot of people, myself included, were anticipating that being that Central Texas is so humid, that was going to create a really big problem.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty incredible. And did you notice, like, I was thinking, like, there's that weird uptick on, like, all of your graphs in the paper. Did it, like, recently rain? Does rain or could rain have, like, a huge impact on this?
So there were a couple days of just minor showers throughout the study. But, I mean, summers here are pretty dry. So overall, it was a very dry summer. But the very end of my study was Hurricane Harvey. and so at the very end, there were a couple days of just scattered showers. And then I actually couldn't even go out for like 3 or 4 days because there was so much rainfall. which definitely had an effect on the moisture content of the individuals. Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy. Did you like look into how much, like what the uptick was on like rehydration?
It really didn't seem to have that much of an effect on it. You know, there may have been, you know, an incredibly minor uptick, and then a day later it was kind of following that same pattern. But definitely after Harvey, it didn't so much rehydrate the tissue to a point that it looked, you know, like normal tissue would. It kind of just turned it to mush almost. So yeah, it definitely caused some rehydration, but not in a way that kind of maintained kind of like the integrity or what you'd expect tissue to look like.
Sure. Yeah. And it's interesting, just like looking at those curves of moisture loss, like through time, and how like within the first couple hundred ADD hours, those thermal units, it drops substantially. And I know that you had kind of the donors in cages and they were nude. How do you expect that the fact that they're in cages and the fact they weren't clothed might impact kind of what you did?
So they were in cages to prevent predominantly like aerial scavengers, so vultures. We have a pretty significant vulture population. But the nice thing about the cages is that it does not inhibit like insect scavenging or insect activity. I think having them clothed is definitely something that I want to look at further, you know, definitely when I do like my dissertation research.
Yeah, especially for somebody with moisture content, you'd expect that evaporation has to be some big part of this. So having much more sun exposure would kind of make this faster. But in your study, you found like that solar radiation had very little impact. It was kind of negligible.
Which was super surprising. And it definitely makes me wonder if it truly does have that negligible amount of an effect, or if it is, you know, like a linearity of just being so closely tied to temperature. And then another thing, or, you know, possible explanation that I've come up with is just that, you know, in a perfect world, all of the donors would have been placed in completely sunlit areas, which is just not possible. The weather station wasn't a completely sunlit area. And so one thing that I'd like to do with kind of further research is also do like infrared temperature readings and see what the sun exposure does to the actual surface temperature of the body as well, and see if it really is, you know, just temperature and not solar radiation.
Yeah, no, I think that's a perfect way to structure looking at exactly that thing. And I think that would add another level of fidelity in being able to do this type of work. How would you want this to be used by practitioners, or like how do you see this being incorporated either into practice or into future research?
I think as it stands right now, it's really important to me that people don't kind of miss the point of the research. You know, the point of it is not to be a standalone conclusive study. It was really, is this possible? And if it is, we need a baseline. We need a study that takes place somewhere that we know mummification happens. And so I think in practice, it's not at a point that it can be applied, because, you know, I don't know if every moisture reader is going to give the exact same results, because the moisture reader itself is actually manufactured for wood. When I was trying to figure out how to collect this data, I just reached out to basically every company I could find. Elmhurst, actually, they got back to me and they were like, actually, yeah, you know, I think that we do have this that would work for you. And so they recommended it just based on the wide range of measurements that it could take, because we didn't know what to expect. And the electrodes themselves, they sent me not the electrodes that typically come standard. They're actually insulated on the sides.
I was interested. So in the mummification, you said, like, for all intents and purposes, what was around like 2000 ADD, or about 10% moisture content, it kind of plateaus. Is that kind of like a hard and fast mummy cutoff value? I have no idea, I guess.
So I don't really know yet. That's one of those things that, you know, a two-year master's program does not really lend itself to a lot of longitudinal study. And so one thing that I want to do once I have, you know, the ability to do a long-term study is to see, is that 10%, between 10 and 20%, is that mummification? Is that where it stops? Or does it hang out there and then, you know, drop a little bit lower? So it certainly looks like that's where, you know, the mummification point happens. But I definitely want to explore to see if that is kind of the true mummification.
Could you just briefly explain the way that the moisture reader works? Because like I thought that was so fascinating.
Yeah, so my understanding, and that's not my area of expertise. Basically, there's just an electrical current that goes through the two electrodes. And so it's able to then, with some process, provide basically a percent saturation level. Since they were insulated, it's really just getting that skin moisture content. It's not puncturing through. I didn't want to look at, you know, internal mummification. That was outside the scope of what I wanted.
Is there something about this you think might be missed or that you hope doesn't get missed?
I mean, I think kind of like we said, mostly just the understanding that this is really a springboard study, for lack of a better term. One of the things that I noticed both when I, because this was my thesis, so when I was, you know, defending my thesis and taking questions and even going through the revision process, you know, the insect activity and how that had an effect. Did you look at this? And it's like, yeah. Yes, I'm sure it did have an effect. I would explore that. But, you know, if you look at every single possible thing you want to look at in your thesis, you're never going to graduate.
Yeah. No, it's a practice in focusing detail and answering one tiny slice. It's not change the world. Same with a dissertation. It's not a change the world thing. It's find an interesting question, figure out how to answer it, do the best you can, and move on.
I think one of the biggest takeaways is this is a possible pathway of research that should be pursued, and I can't do all of it as much as I want to. And so I think really just understanding, like, and acknowledging, you know, absolutely, I could not account for all the variables. You know, I didn't have a large enough sample size to be able to say definitively, yes, chemotherapy patients decompose differently. So I think really just keeping in mind that this is not by any means a conclusive study. This is, yes, this is possible.
Yeah, it's possible. And it does trend in a way that we can use it predictively. Last question I have, how would you set up like your perfect research design for this?
Okay. So in a perfect world, I would have, I don't even want to put a number on how many donors I would have. All of them. Give me everybody. I want
an infinite population size.
Yeah, because I think that's something that is really unfortunate and restricting about studies like this, in that there's no way around it, but you're restricted to the population of individuals that donate their bodies to science and to essentially your facility specifically. And so, you know, they're not super well represented in terms of age or socioeconomic class. And so I think in a perfect world, we would all be able to do these studies on really all-encompassing populations. I definitely want to pursue this, you know, over at least the course of the year. I really want to see that seasonality and really see if that continues at that 10 or 20% asymptote like it looks like it does. I'd also like to look at the difference between clothed and unclothed and see if that actually does make a difference. And if it does, why? Find a way to really measure the insect activity and measure, you know, yes, there was a maggot mass here, and then 2 days later, it had dropped this much. I'd also like to look at, you know, see if full shade, full sun, partial, how much of a difference that makes, especially with, you know, looking at surface temperature. And then also looking at different, like soil and ground types.
No, it's awesome. So it's exploring kind of like all of the potential covariates that, you might be able to account for. Yeah. And there are so many.
Yes. There are so many.
Many thanks to Autumn for taking the time to have a chat about her paper. Our second paper is by Dr. Chris Meyer and Rebecca George, entitled Examining Differences in Presumed Migrants from Texas and Arizona Using Cranial and Dental Data. This paper explores the differences in the biological expression of morphological traits from the cranium and dentition among peoples of European, African, and Native American ancestries with those of two separate Latinx samples of presumed migrants from Texas and Arizona, respectively. Now, for a little context, these morphological traits have been shown to have some genetic basis for their expression, and this can be something like the relative width of the nose in relation to its height, or how large a certain tooth cusp is relative to some published standards. Multitudes of previous research has shown that there are no individual traits that are unique to any one group, regardless of how that group is defined. However, suites of these traits do significantly vary by group and thus can be useful for practical and applied purposes, namely an accurate estimation of an unknown's ancestry. The two Latinx presumed migrant groups are significantly different from the reference samples and from one another, demonstrating the difficulty in using a blanket term like Hispanic. One of my favorite aspects of this paper is that it examines both the cranium and dentition instead of just one or the other. And that is of real practical importance because each of these complexes shows different patterns of variation that are aligned with known population histories. As we move forward as a field, I believe that incorporating multiple regions of the skeleton into one cohesive model will only allow us to ask and answer bigger questions. So I was able to schedule an interview with Chris and Rebecca to talk with them a little more in detail about their paper.
All right, well, I don't want to take up too much of your time, so we'll just kind of jump right into it. Since I have both of you here, if you both want to kind of take turns just kind of giving the basic idea of the paper, just like with three main takeaways, right? So like just briefly describe what it is, what you did, what you found out, and like what are three big takeaways from it? And it'd be interesting to get your individual points of view on that.
So
that's Dr. Chris Myers.
I am going to talk about what the paper was about, but I also think it might be interesting just briefly to talk about like why we did it. So Becca and I both, we went to school together, and we both study dental morphology, and we figured out, I think right as I was about to leave, or maybe we had known, but Becca hadn't collected data yet, that we were both going to be working at PCOME to get data and at OPID.
That's the Pima County Office of the Medical Examiner and Operation ID. I'll have some more information after the interview.
And so we had these overlapping data sets, but since we were there at different times, we didn't have the same individuals. And so we thought, okay, let's put this together and see what we can see. I mainly work with cranial morphoscopics and dental morphology. And so we were interested in looking at those two data sets together. Could we tell these two populations apart? I thought maybe we could. In my dissertation, I, at the time, had treated them all as one group, which we'll talk about is not probably best practice. But that's what I did in the dissertation. And what I had found was that combining cranial and dental data, you do get an improvement across the board. But the biggest improvement I saw was incorrect classifications of what I was calling Hispanic. And so moving from that result, I really wanted to sort of look, okay, now if I separate these out, is there a difference there and can we see it? And so I think my three main takeaways, and I think I'll just jump right to that and let Becca tell you a little bit more about the rest of the paper. One, that we have different information being, if you want to say, stored in the cranial traits and the dental traits, and you get more information looking at them together. So really, we should be. The second one, I think, is not a revolutionary takeaway, but is still important, that there are problems with using the word Hispanic, which we know. And if you're going to choose to use it in place of something else, at least you need to be explicit in terms of what that means in the context of how you're using it. And then the last one, I think, is no matter what groups you're looking at for ancestry or population affinity, and not necessarily limited to Latinx groups, understanding those populations' specific histories and the biocultural implications of what they have been through is going to affect what we can see in the skeleton, and that we collectively, in studying population affinity, need to incorporate that more.
So
here's Rebecca George.
For me, within this paper, we have separated them as different groups, you know, where we're treating OPID as individuals that are have been dying, crossing through Texas. They are one group. PCOME is a separate group of other individuals who have been dying coming through Arizona, and really making that separation. I mean, we have seen that in the literature more recently. But yeah, like Chris was saying, even a couple years ago, like when he was doing his dissertation, everyone was just treating them as migrant groups. I might have done that in my own thesis. I don't remember. We're not going back there. So kind of building on that is, like, for me, the main takeaways is, once again, don't pool migrant groups just because they're migrants. They have their own identities. We know from the individuals who've been identified that they are coming from separate locations. And that's something that we have to to keep in mind. Of course, pulling in the population history is critical. You know, if you don't know where your samples are coming from, how can you possibly talk about them in a modern context? And really just being aware of the terms that we are using for ancestry. You know, we finally shifted away from those terrible racial terms, but are we getting much better with some of our ancestral terms that we're using and things like that?
How difficult has inconsistent nomenclature made this type of research at large, I guess?
So for me, it's not so much that the nomenclature itself has been difficult, because in the very least, as biological anthropologists, we understand that Hispanic is a terrible term to use. We're going to keep using it, right? And that's what everyone's been doing. But people have been really good about addressing where their samples have been coming from. So that has been helpful in kind of taking the information in studies such as Kate Spradley's work and Ann Ross's work. You might have been using Hispanic at some point, but I know that your samples are coming from sites X, Y, and Z. Really, the other biggest thing with the nomenclature has been the acceptance of kind of using other terms, even such as Latino or Latinx. So I know we were both really happy when one of the editors suggested changing Latino to Latinx within this paper. And we were like, yeah, step forward. So that was really exciting for us.
Why do you think this shift happened to be more accepting? Do you think it's more of like a need-based, because the unidentified border crossing population is growing and growing, that now people are only starting to come around in terms of nomenclature because it is more useful to use more specific terminology or to agree on something or, yeah, anything?
At least in the last couple years.
That's Dr. Chris Meyer again.
There's just been a shift in how we talk about ancestry and ancestry estimation as a whole, where more and more people that maybe are more cognizant of some of the baggage that language has are advancing their careers and coming into higher positions where they can affect change, or if they make one of these changes, it's not sort of shunted away.
What is an aspect of this research that you think is important that might get missed?
Honestly, I'm going right back to the population history thing, just because it is such a huge part of this paper.
Here's Rebecca George again.
And it's fairly new within forensic anthropology. You know, something that my advisor, Dr. Mermplute, had even kind of thrown at me a couple years ago. I was like, hey, rather than doing a straight ancestry dissertation, why don't you start pushing population history and including that and thinking about these other aspects? Because, of course, as we all know, our governing bodies are trying to work on these documents, but it's hard. And if they can't even agree on it, well, how are we supposed to do it? And really just kind of thinking about the context of our samples rather than just throwing it out and assuming that everybody knows where these individuals are from.
Okay.
And Dr. Meyer again.
I also had the population history written down, but I had a backup because I suspected that was going to be Becca's answer. Mine's more of a pragmatic one, but I think it is something that I want to point out. Especially for the morphoscopic traits we looked at, and even some of the dental traits, there's a reasonable number of them where we didn't find differences or we found slight differences. And so I think it would be really easy to read this paper, see the slight or no differences, and just jump to the conclusion that for most purposes, we can still just use the blanket term because they aren't really showing differences. And I don't think that's really the correct way, obviously, to read this. I think what is important about that is, yes, maybe not everything is different, but the differences do exist, and these traits are occurring at different frequencies in these different populations. And maybe if we were actually paying attention to those differences, we'd have a little bit more success discriminating between them, and that could help us make better identifications and resolve cases more quickly. Slight differences are still differences, and we need to be paying more attention to them.
Yeah, I love that, and it's a perfect segue into how you would recommend this article being utilized by practitioners. Yeah, I'm interested in both your takes on how you would like to see this be used, either in practice or for further research.
I think the paper as it stands probably has relatively limited practical use because we didn't do anything with classification. But I do think where it is useful is it identifies these differences, and maybe more importantly, those differences are consistent with what we have seen in other types of data that isn't morphological, right? So it's consistent with what we have seen in craniometrics. It's consistent with what we have seen in genetics. And so it sort of almost rounds out a lot of the different data types that we use as anthropologists, saying, okay, all of these things say that these populations are different, and that can allow us to start going forward and building projects where we're treating them separately.
So kind of building on what Chris has said, kind of taking that and even adding in other data sources. So if I remember correctly, we touched a little bit on some of the genetics, but even if geneticists started using some of the saying, oh, okay, look at, even if we were to build backwards, because usually as anthropologists, we like to build forward and say, here's the genetic differences. What are we finding phenotypically, right? So I think even kind of doing that and seeing this as a stepping stone for even other types of data that are being used and trying to distinguish among populations. And particularly within anthropology, not even specifically forensic anthropology, just seeing how we have taken some of the terminology and how we are reapplying it. And just thinking about how we have kind of redefined these things. And once again, you know, we're not just using one trait to define a group. It's like, here's all these different frequencies. Yes, once again, there's some similarities, but there's other differences. And we need to kind of start looking into these a little bit further. So I really think of this kind of a stepping stone for some other work that can be done.
How would you set up your perfect kind of research design to study this further? It could be like, in a perfect world, I want all these data sets, or it could be with the data that you've already collected and you want people to collect more or future directions, pretty much carte blanche. How would you set up the perfect experiment for this, I guess?
I think the perfect experiment for what the kinds of things we're looking at here requires more identified individuals. Because one of the reasons that we didn't take this a step further to build something classificatory is that we still have a lot of unknowns in the sample of unidentified, where we are using the profile, both biological and cultural, of who these people are, and assuming that they are migrants and therefore that they match the profile of the other migrants that have come through those places. But if they're unidentified, we have no idea where they're coming from. And so that's just going to introduce noise into the classification.
That'd be great to have more modern Latinx samples from across the U.S. because we don't really know what they look like on kind of a biological level in terms of the phenotypic stuff that we look at. The samples just aren't large enough there. So it's been a bit of an issue kind of running into that. So yeah, dream research, great. I'd love there are those modern populations.
Thanks so much to Dr. Chris Meyer and Rebecca George. Our last interview for this episode is with Arian Maggio, who, along with her colleagues Ambika Flavel and Daniel Franklin, proposed a simplified and inexpensive procedure to produce high-quality histological slides. Please welcome Arian Maggio to discuss her paper entitled A Simplified Protocol for the Histological Preparation of Cortical Bone Samples for Light Microscopy, a revision of the Garcia Donis et al. 2017. So if you could just kind of explain what the basic idea of the paper is and what three major takeaways you see are from it.
Okay, so the basic idea of the paper was that it's possible to make good quality thin sections of cortical bone without using expensive equipment or overly complicated protocols. Necessity is the mother of invention. If you don't have a lot of funding, you might not be able to afford the equipment, but that doesn't mean you can't still do the research or do the work that you need to do. Often we get a little bit too caught up in doing things a particular way because we need to have a particular type of equipment, or because someone has done it that way, we don't really question that as much as we should. And so one of the other key takeaways I think people should get is that it's important to test protocols as they come out, to validate them, see what works for you and adapt them to your own circumstances, because what might work in one setting what might not work in another. So in our particular circumstance, we don't have access to a lot of that equipment. But we also do a lot of archaeological work where we might need to have a field lab setting. So having equipment that you can move is very useful. And a third takeaway is that archaeological material is a bit more complicated, but it is possible to prepare and image it. It just takes a few more steps.
I think that's amazing. And that's one of my favorite things about this article is exactly what you pointed out, is that, yeah, these protocols are important and they need to be validated. But if you can't afford a $100,000 microtome to make like beautiful thin sections all the time, what protocol matters if no one has that machine? You know what I'm saying? So having something that is adaptable to so many labs and then also flexible and that you can move it around is like such a big deal, particularly for these types of things, especially I would imagine in archaeological settings where the bony material might be a little more friable and that you do need to have that type of field analysis.
For some of the archaeological material that we were looking at, you might not need to section it on site, but if you can embed it then and there, that also helps when you're transporting it.
What is an aspect of this research that you think is important that might get missed?
One of the more important aspects of the research was that we did actually test it on different species with different preservation levels and fixation types. There were two types of human samples. So there was human cadaveric bone, which was formalin fixed, so from teaching cadavers. There was also archaeological human bone of relatively poor preservation. We also had kangaroo bone, which was fresh, frozen, then macerated. And we had canine bone that was partially formalin fixed.
What are some of the potential downfalls of not having a consistent preparation protocol?
As with anything, if you don't have a standard method, if someone is then trying to reproduce your results, they may not get the same results, and that's bad science. You want to be able to reproduce what people have done. You can also get different image qualities if you're using different preparation techniques, which can result in different results. It can introduce error if you're doing histomorphometry. So things like preparation methods which involve decalcifying bone, they will have a different result to if you're just doing grinding and not taking out the calcium in the bone. It's effectively taking the posts out of a tent. You're taking the structural component away, and then you're trying to measure the structure. You're not going to get the same results as if you just left it there.
What is like the time cost for like a trained technician to go through the steps in this protocol?
Okay, so from start to finish for one slide, under optimum conditions, it's 3 days, which is not that long, and most of that is waiting for resin to cure. So when you've extracted the bone, you've then got to resin embed it. That resin takes 24 hours to cure under optimum conditions, which is temperature-based. So if it's cooler, then it will take longer than 24 hours. If you introduce thinner because you're trying to reduce bubbles, depending on the amount of thinner, that can also increase the time. And that's the same if you use epoxy resin or if you use the resin that we used, which is polyester-based. So then cutting it is very quick because you're just doing one slice. Grinding it down, if you've cut it thin enough, can take less than 5 minutes. And then, again, you've got to glue it. So resin again. So that's 24 hours, resin again, 24 hours. So roughly 3 days.
I guess, is there any way in which that you can augment your method to kind of speed it up in some meaningful way?
You won't be able to get it past the 24-hour cure, because if you cure it too quickly, the resin becomes brittle and you'll actually damage. Because it's exothermic, as the resin is curing, it gets hot as well. You don't want to damage your actual sample that's inside that resin. But you can if it's you're in a cooler environment. If you've got a incubator or an oven that you can set to like 30 to 40 degrees, you can put it in there as well.
Is there anything lost or sacrificed in terms of information gain by following the protocols as you have set forth?
So if you're looking to do very high magnifications, we were able to do up to about 400 to 1,000, so we could see the osteocytes. It depends on how thin you grind it down when you're getting towards that 1,000 mark. If you're then wanting to look at something smaller than that, or you're wanting to do scanning electron microscopy, then you might want to use a different resin, because it's to do with the refraction index of the resin. You're not going to be able to see as much as you need to see. When you're doing grinding and polishing, if you're going to look at it at really high resolution, so beyond that 400 times, you may want to use even more finer grit. So we only used 600 and 1200, but you can go up to 4000, so depending on what grits you've got. And that will help reduce any artifacts that have been left from like cut marks and grinding marks at those higher grits. But for most histomorphometry, the smallest thing that you tend to be measuring is the osteocytes. So at 400 times, I could measure the osteocytes.
Thanks to Aryan Maja for sitting down to chat, and thanks to all of the authors that took part in this inaugural companion podcast for the journal Forensic Anthropology. If you have any ideas of what you would like to hear from this podcast, or any questions you might have for previous authors, please feel free to reach out to us on Twitter at JForensicAnth or shoot the editors an email. You can find their contact information via the link in our bio. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to exploring this new avenue to stimulate more discussions within our field. This episode was written and produced by me, Michael Kennyhurst. The intro music is a song called Ghoul Town, written and performed by Elena Brooks and myself. Lastly, thank you to the University of Florida Press for their continued support.